last night, but I've got an energy drink in my hand, and so hopefully the yawns will be to a bare minimum this morning.
Well, I think we'll be just fine. I think we've got all the stuff kind of settled in. A couple things before we get into the last bits of where we're going to start for our study. Number one, there are some weather alerts for the Atlanta area, and so we are going to do our very best to keep the stream stable and going in the course of the study. I can make no promises. I cannot control the internets. I can do my best to manage them. And so that is something we've got going on. In addition to that, there's a game I'm aware of that takes place in some of Jared's online Bible classes. Apparently, he has a 1 minute a yawn ratio going on. We're going to try to keep him engaged and stretch that out to maybe a one yawn per 5 minutes, one yawn per 6 minutes to keep ourselves alert and intense into the class. I'm sure he'll pick on me in a second in some way or another. But right now what I want us to do is to kind of think back to the story of Gideon that we've kind of studied so far. Gideon begins as the drama unfolds for us in chapter 6 as stepping into conflict not with a national enemy. There's a spiritual conflict that has mainly a connection to his own personal religious background. The spirituality of his father is really the conflict that's there. And with that conflict and with all of those struggles, comes the inevitable showdown in the city square between him and his father, and really kind of tears down that backdrop. He still is, to a small degree, Gideon the Cowardly Lion. He hasn't really grown to whom he could be. And he's shown to us to have such great spiritual potential. That moves forward, and he does rise. And Gideon does move in a spiritually positive direction. But the story doesn't end there. It actually just opens up there. And that moves us to looking at one of the most familiar parts of the story of Gideon, which is the fleece exchange. For most Christians I've met, most people I know, they kind of associate a fleece more so with Greco-Roman culture and the golden fleece than this fleece. And we struggle with figuring out, well, we got that fleece, this fleece, what's going on there? In practicality, we talked about last time, this fleece is a pagan offering concept of a call response with the meal that's offered. And the dialogue that takes place with God is another testing phase that's kind of not so much what God wants, but it's what Gideon gives. And God still answers and responds. But that moves us forward to where we're at right now. And Jared, basically what we have on the table, is there something else important that we want to bring up?
No, I mean, I think that's the main thing, is we're going to see that this question of how like your father, what do you do with the idols after you've torn down, right? You know, as Jesus would say, you've driven the demons out from you, but what do you replace it with, right? Because that is going to be a problem we're going to see in the life of Gideon. And it starts almost immediately once we get into the text today.
Yeah. And just as a quick reminder, we'll show this again. I'm going to bring this up. This is the ring structure and the fatal funnel. And remember, the Gideon side we're at right now is Gideon's rise and the conflict that comes up out of it. And so Gideon is actually in a best place spiritually that we find him in right now. It will not stay that way, and there is a shift in the story. But we're going to move in the text to chapter 7, I think it's verse 9, is where we're going to read from, all the way through verse 14. And Jared, if you could read that for us, it'd be great.
Sure. Now that same night, the Lord said to Gideon, "Get up, go down against the camp, because I've given it into your hand. But if you're afraid to go down into the camp with Purah, your slave, and you'll hear what they say. And afterward, your hand will be strengthened to go down against the camp." So we went down with Purah, his slave, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east lay along the valley like a locust in abundance, and their camels without number like the sand on the seashores in abundance. And when Gideon came, behold, a man was telling a dream to his comrade. And he said, "Listen up, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it, so it fell down and turned over, and the tent lay flat." His comrade said, Well, that must be none other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all of the camp.
So there's a couple of things in this text that are kind of important for us. On the one hand, this is looking really good. But as is often the case with the inspired writers of the scriptures, there is levels of foreshadowing that we see a lot in literary works written by men, that God is sneaking into this story. But before we peel those layers off too much, what's going on here?
Well, we've already seen that Gideon has just been trembling from the very beginning, right? He's trembling at the beginning of the story when God shows up. He is trembling at the spring of trembling when he gets his people winnowed down. He's been worried when he's asking God for the fleece, and he's not listened to God. But God says, okay, if you're not going to listen to me, maybe you'll listen to the enemy, right? And so he sends him, and he's like, and I know you're scared. You don't want to do anything on your own. Take slaves again like you did the first time, but go. And he takes a slave, and he goes down, and he hears kind of like what happens a lot of times in the Bible. God has sent the enemy a dream. Just like God sends Pharaoh dreams or Nebuchadnezzar dreams. Here, though, the interpreter isn't an Israelite. It's the other Midianite guard. And even though Gideon hasn't really trusted so much God here, he's finally going to listen to the Midianite who says, yeah, he's going to attack us and he's going to take us out.
Right. And so I think there's a lot that we can kind of capture in all of that that's important for us to know and important for us to understand that God is trying to guide a weak heart into a strong heart. As a second narrative in this, I think it's kind of really important. Because he's taking someone who is reluctant and afraid and giving him the tools to be strong. I think it's an application point for all of us, because I'll just say it real simply, we need that kind of message. We need the message that says, when you're weak, God will actually give the things you need around you to help you be strong, even in the process part. We think, okay, well, I got to get strong first to go do the thing. God has a way to take a person while they're weak and give them a bridge to climb up and to be successful on.
Yeah, I mean, that's in, the whole point in Hebrews 11, right, where we had this Hebrew faith, right, is that the made strong out of weakness. I mean, that's what we're seeing a little bit here, right, is that God's kind of holding his hand and trying to bring him to a place where he will obey, that God's giving him all the tools to try to help that sort of thing occur.
Yeah.
And it's going to work on some level.
Yeah, it's going to be successful, again, much in the same way that David is useful to God as a servant. We think of David being a man after God's own heart because of his willingness to repent, but that's only the core kernel, that's the big kernel we want to chew on. David was useful to God because David accomplished what God needed him to do, much in the same way that these judges who are ranging from those who are abjectly against God, to those who are mildly with God, to some who are trying to be on God's side, to other components in the story of Judges, where you have Midianite kings, you've got absolute pagans in service. They're all useful to God to bring out his ends. Kind of thinking forward also to the use of the Chaldeans and the use of the Assyrians and the use of the other nations that were useful to God, even though we didn't like them. And the Israelites don't like them.
Absolutely.
So scooting forward then, the story continues with this information. He knows this fact now. And you would think that unless the first layer, hey, I'm emboldened. This should embolden us. Is that really the trajectory that goes through the whole arc of his story? Or are there some hints in the way that this story is framed that tell us, yeah, but the not but side?
Yeah, I mean, we are going to see this probably definitely the high point of Gideon is what we get in this next section, kind of going from verse 15 until maybe verse 25 or so, is that he does respond and he is empowered and he is given faith and he does take his 300 guys and he is going to, enact what God has told him to do, right? Mm-hmm. And those things are really good. The question that we're going to have at the end of this little episode and as we spill into chapter 8 is, now that God has given him victory, who does Gideon think is really responsible for that victory? And who should reap the rewards of that victory?
Yeah. And I'll add this. One of the things that I think is a helpful quick reminder, we're approaching the Old Testament narratives, the story where God tells the story to teach us a thing, with that mindset, that God has told us a story to teach us a thing, or two things, or three things. They're not just merely facts on the page. They're not just a dry reading of what has occurred. So let's move forward in the story. Do we want to read some of this, or just story tell it? We're going to try, by the way, for those who are kind of keeping track of these things, to get through the block of Gideon today. So that means all the way through the end of chapter 8.
So that is up to you. Whichever you think.
Oh, putting weight on me. My brain only
Absolutely.
Half a thing at a time right now. Let's go ahead and read at least verses 15 through 18 to start, and then we'll scoot from there and see what we need to add to it. That will kind of bridge to the next section.
Sure. Now, as soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped. And he would return to the camp of Israel and said, "Get up, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand." And he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put trumpets into the hand of all of them, and empty jars with torches inside the jars. And he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. And when I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then blow the trumpets also on every side of the camp and shout, 'For the Lord and for Gideon.'"
Yeah. So I want to make a quick comment about that last clause. And then you could talk about maybe some broader stuff, but it's really familiar, kind of a future look or a callback for us to when David returns from battle alongside Saul and that conflict that takes place. And I think there's some layers we can think through. It's Saul has slain his X number. David has slain more than that. And Saul gets jealous in response to it. And you think about 18 to 22-year-old range David, getting all that kind of praise from all of Israel, instant inflated head. Like, oh, I'm the man. I'm so much the man. They love me more than Saul. And then he goes into that chaotic context. So what about beyond that? Is there something else that we want to pay attention to there too?
Yeah, so this phrase, you know, for the Lord and for X, or for this God and for X, this is a standard ancient Near Eastern battle call.
Yeah.
And we have to keep it in its ancient Near Eastern context because we hear that and we're like, oh, look, this is great. He's calling for the Lord. But he's putting himself as, to some degree, equal to God here. So, for example, we see this all the time in Egyptian reliefs where the Pharaoh is held up as the savior, right? Because in Egyptian context, of course, he's God, right? And that the Pharaoh is the one who's bringing victory. The gods through him, but it emphasizes his power. And all the people are shouting Gideon's name, and they're putting Gideon forward as the savior of the people. And we're at first wondering, okay, what's going on here? Is he setting himself up as an equal to God, or is he not? Is he showing, you know, deference to God? And we're not supposed to be certain yet. But we're going to find out pretty quickly that if that's not exactly what he's thinking right now, it's going to be pretty soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll add this to it. I think it's important for us to kind of catch and capture. This is a human thing, and we do it today. We do it with our political appointees or elected officials. If things go the right way, then they did all the right things. If they go the wrong way, they did all the bad things. Even if they may have done the same things either way, you know, whether it's a presidential side or even just a local community county commissioner, we praise or complain to the human, forgetting that there are other components on the human level. And then in this case, this is a God narrative. And so God is part of this story too. And so for Gideon, this begins to create a story conflict for us. Okay, who's worthy in getting the praise? In part because we know the rest of the story. We know what's going to happen after this. And do we want to take a side note and kind of talk about the whittling down? I think we'll leave that for later. There's questions that come up, and we're trying to answer all of them. We'll probably leave some for the text, and we'll leave it back into the comments and stuff. So adding to this, and so we move into the actual conflict itself around verse 19. With all human conflict in the histories of men fighting men, the way that they're recorded is kind of weird because we can record them in various ways. First person, we can say this person fought that person. Group to group, we can say this unit fought this unit. Nation to nation, we can say this nation fought this nation. But in the end, they only give us a really thimble full view of what actually takes place in conflict. And so when verse 19 opens up, so Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch when they had just set the watch. There are a couple of things that are like, okay, but what else is going on here in our minds? Because we've gone down to a smaller group here, 100 men. But then there's also something else, because there's some callbacks here that are not so much about the war. They're about the connection that Gideon has to the history of Israel and to God that become more important than the actual conflict. And so 19 to 23 range as that arbitrary number picked out of the larger section that kind of closes out chapter 7. What are we supposed to learn about ourselves and God in this text as we walk through it and maybe read through it, Jared?
So one thing Edwin brought up and kind of jumped the gun on this, I appreciate the comment though, is he notes that here we have kind of an echo of what, you know, Paul talks about in Ephesians, and that is that God has whittled down the army so that they would know who accomplishes the victory. They can't boast that they're the ones who defeat the enemy. We're going to see here that it's the Lord who turns the swords of the enemies against each other. But it kind of goes along with what Jen Venuso mentions as well, and that's that in spite of this fact, they're still going to miss the point. That Gideon says for the Lord and for Gideon, and he tells the people, look at what I do what I do, and not do what God commands. And so this is kind of an anti-Jericho situation as well, where in Jericho, of course, they also have to surround an enemy. They also have to blow trumpets, and God is also going to give them the victory.
Yeah.
But Achan, you remember what happens in Jericho. They're supposed to dedicate the entire thing. And remember what Achan does? He takes some of the forbidden stuff, and that's going to be the cause of ruin for Israel. Well, we're going to see a similar sort of thing is going to happen here too.
Yeah, definitely. There is, it starts well, it ends bad, is kind of how this war plays itself out. Because it's not what he does tactically that solves the problem. It's not because he's sneakier, he's stronger, he's faster, he's quicker, he's wiser, he's the best general ever. There is a shift in the text and a statement that takes place. Verse 22 in particular. Jerry, why don't you read verse 22 and 23 for us? I think those are two important verses that end one thing and begin another.
Sure. Now, when they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set each man's sword against his comrade and against all the army. And the army fled as far as Bet Shittah towards Zererah at the border of Abel-Mahaloah by Tabat. And the men of Israel were called out from Naphtali and from Asher and from all of Manasseh, and they pursued after Midian.
So, as we pointed out, the victory comes not so much because of Gideon's leadership, his strength, his great qualities, but the Lord sets the swords against one another. But as we pointed out, they still had to be on the field. Mm-hmm. They were participants and servants rather than successors and kings, if you will. But there's also something that takes place in the shift. The shift goes from storytelling of this victory the Lord accomplishes, and then you see a louder host of Israelites who are participants, although there are some missing portions to it that I think is important for us to pay attention to, because you kind of would expect that, hey, wait a minute, this is a big deal. The Lord has raised Gideon up. The Lord is using Gideon. He's not a tribal context, small area context guy. He's a big context guy. So what are we going to see now? We're going to look at the last few verses of the text all the way through chapter 7 now to kind of see the rest of the story unfold. Verse 24 and following tell the pursuit story. And so before we get to 24, what's our missing statement here?
The missing statement is that now the 300, now that they've won this victory, everybody else gets called out. All those soldiers from all the different tribes. And these are all the tribes with an eastern focus. They're the Transjordan tribes. They're the tribes that, of course, that are most worried by Midian. And we read that, well, everybody shows up except for who you'd expect, Ephraim, the most powerful tribe there is. They don't show up at all. Until we read what's going to happen there in 24. And that's going to be the seeds of some controversy.
Right. And again, Gideon should have been the most powerful person there because God was with him. Ephraim should have been the most powerful tribe, but they weren't with them at all. It was like little story tips. And then let's go ahead and read verses 24 through the end of the chapter together.
So Gideon sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim saying, come down against the Midianites and capture the fords against them as far as Bet-Barah and also the Jordan. So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they captured the fords as far as Bet-Barah and also of the Jordan. And they captured the two princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeev. And they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeev they killed at the winepress of Zeev. And they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeev to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan.
Yeah. So messages get sent, and all of a sudden, no, here I am. We're ready to. So they capture the fords, they capture the princes of Midian, and they bring tribute. To whom? And that's and what kind of tribute?
And what's the purpose of it as well? Because what we're going to see, and it's this kind of weird chapter division, honestly, there is because that really goes along with better what's happening in chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, is because this is them not just bringing tribute. This is them having a beef with Gideon. This is them going to be covering their shame because they didn't get the victory. They were not, and so they have got a question. Should they blame themselves for not showing up and gaining the greater victory? Or can they blame somebody else?
Yeah.
And what are they willing to do to guard their honor?
Right. And to put it in a little New Testament rivalry context, you think about the workers who go to the field. Jesus uses a similar kind of illustrative context to talk about how the master rewards the laborers without respect to when they join the task. And so the agreement was this. This is the reward. That's a principle that underlies this negative behavior that is the other fold of it. They didn't do the work fully, but now they're griping about the pay, in essence, is kind of what you see in this response. And I think it's important to note that they bring these heads to Gideon as opposed to giving honor to God. And so there's some level of, here's a thing to pay attention to. We don't have all the answers to all this stuff in the text or otherwise, but it's contentious because the rest of the story is now contentious. Like they're not happy people. They're certainly wound up. not COVID. Allergies, it's the season still.
Cough for COVID, right?
Yeah, cough for COVID. That's the game we still play. Apologize for that. But verses 1 through 3, chapter 8. This is the important second phase of this conflict, but it's also important to note, and I'm going to bring this back up again, just as it's important, where this sits in the structure of the text. The seventh chapter closes out around verse 25 with everything being better than it is in the second half of Gideon's story here, beginning verse 1. And so, as you remember, the funnel, it's drawing them downward. They're drawing us to a natural conclusion as it's positioned there. But it's also connecting us to another part of the story. And you can kind of see this in the epilogue. What happens now, and this is a foreshadowing, of the very awful last parts of Judges. And so everything that happens here is going to be amplified in the epilogue is a way that I think about it. So you already kind of hinted at some of this. How do we know that this is like a contention argument of status beyond the obvious layers of the text? Is there something important we want to pay attention to, or is it just as we read, as we see?
So there's some things that we're going to just see as we read, but you know, if you wanted to put up the kind of the fatal funnel, or if you wanted to put up the kind of the ring structure, it might make it a little easier to understand, is that up to this point, up to the end of chapter 7, let's think about what Gideon has done. Okay, yes, he may have lacked some faith. Yes, there may be some little worrisome little things, but he has fought against the Canaanites. He has torn down idols. He has done what God has said, and he's at least held up God and worshiped him. But now, starting here, who are his enemies going to be? Who's he going to be fighting? It's not the Canaanites.
Yeah.
He's going to be fighting the Israelites, killing each other off in civil war. He instead of tearing down idols, so, you know, spoiler alert, what's going to happen at the end here, he's going to be building up idols. And instead of giving glory to God and worshiping God, he's going to be taking glory for himself. And those sorts of things, these petty arguments, they're all going to be about status, right? The Ephraimites are accusing him because they don't look as good as they should. They know the preeminent tribe. Gideon's from a know-nothing, you know, spot of nowhere. And Gideon has to kind of appease them in that way by bringing that up. And the only reason, though, the Ephraimites are willing to do this now is because, remember, how many men does Gideon have with him?
Yeah.
It's just 300.
Yeah. You know, and from the perception of the earthly heart, we can totally take you. Not knowing where God stands in the sense of this relationship, and the Ephraimites don't know. They know, but they don't know, is kind of where they're at. But you also see this whole sense in the text of verse 2, you know, this, aren't your grapes better than their grapes, your harvest better, like this whole little petty mess that takes place. But then it moves forward in all of this to some really dire things. But I want to point something out. This is really a thing that I think is poignant. We look at the text of Judges and we want a hero. The best we get are anti-heroes. You know, that are not really heroes, but they're wearing the shoes of heroes sometimes, kind of. The end of chapter 7 and the beginning of chapter 8 is our last chance for a hero. Gideon is the hero that could have been, that we want to have in Judges. We want these guys to be winners. We want them to be more faithful than they are presented to us in the totality of their lives. And so this is a seminal moment in the text. Like, it's the time when the story can go either way, as the inspired message is being laid out to us. So chapter 8, say verse 4 and following, you know, is the, and then the, here's the rest of the story. You know, verse 4, and Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over, and he and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted yet pursuing. And so, you know, that's kind of how the story opens up, and you can visualize that they're booking it, they're moving, but they're running out of steam. And so there is something shifting in this that's incrementally important. So say verses 4 through 9 for right now. Let's summarize that. We're going to read some more, maybe highlight a few things, but what's really important here in this section?
So here they are. They're following and chasing the Midianites now. There are still 15,000 Midianites, and all Gideon's got is 300 dudes. Well, they need supplies. They need provisions. They need, you know, a breather here. And so they come to the Israelite town of Succoth, okay, which is a place of rest. That's what Succoth really is about. And they ask him for bread. And Succoth, now this is an Israelite village, looks at their own people and are like, why should we help you? Because if we're aiding and abetting the enemy, there's 15,000 of them. You haven't won yet. The heads of these guys aren't in your power. We're not going to help you because they're thinking in a worldly focus. If they help Gideon, once Gideon loses, well, what's going to happen from the Canaanites? They're going to come in and they're going to get revenge on them for helping Gideon. Well, Gideon recognized this, right? But notice what he says. When I come back, when I am victorious, I'm going to break down your tower.
Yeah. You know, and even though the wording is, well, when the Lord has given Zerah and Zonah into my hand, I will. So don't make any like, well, the Lord's mentioned, yes, but the Lord's going to give it to him, and he's going to make the independent decision to bring about the punishing, which is a typical response to this kind of, oh, you're not going to do it my way? Well, this threat is not really outside the realm of possibilities for the history of the area. It's something that was done culturally in the surrounding pagan cultures, not biblical, by the way. This is not what the law expects the Israelite to do to the Israelite, period. And so that's another cue that, hey, this is not really how it should be.
It's kind of transitioned from providing liberation to the people to gaining personal glory and status, right? Because otherwise, why would it be offended that they're not helping him out?
So that's kind of the shift, because there's that shift from what God called Gideon to do, his mission, to what Gideon becomes. And it catches into our subtitle or broad title for the text, a warlord. He's becoming the thing that he wasn't. He is being transformed. He was Gideon, the cowardly lion who wouldn't serve, who he's Gideon now, who contends with Baal, however you want to pronounce that, to then becoming Gideon that we really don't like. Like, we don't like anything about this Gideon when we could have loved the story of Gideon. So say verses 10 through 17, which is the next textual chunk. Let's read verses 10 through 12, and maybe we'll talk about verses 13 through 17 or vice versa. You pick.
Let's read 13 through 17. That's the more exciting stuff.
Okay, so let's talk about 10 through 12 real quick. What goes on there?
Anything so we, I mean, the main thing, right, is that we have him, Gideon's come upon the enemy, and we don't have a lot of focus, right? He surprises them. He throws into a panic. They've defeated the enemy. And here, though, we don't have explicitly the emphasis there of God. Yeah. But they win, right? And we know the only way that 300 people are going to defeat 15,000 is through God's help. That's a pretty simple thing. But we don't have him focused on this. We don't have him mention this. This is to him almost in the background of what's going on. So now that he's won, he's got to go back and he's going to wreak personal vengeance on Israelites, right? And that's where we run into with verses 13 through 17. I've been reading a lot. Why don't you read for us okay. now?
So beginning Judges chapter 8, verse 13. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres, and he captured a young man of Succoth, and questioned him. And he wrote down for him the officials and the elders of Succoth and 77 men. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Behold, Zeba and Zalamunna," making up all pronunciations because I can, "about whom you taunted me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalamunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted?' And he took the elders of the city, and he took the thorns of the wilderness and the briars with them, and taught the men of Succoth a lesson. And he broke down the tower of Penuel, and killed the men of the city." And I think one of the literary events that take place there is he taught them a lesson. There's a lot of a undertone of discipline applied, but not in the context of he had the right to do so, I think is really important on at least one quick reading level. And think this is not just like exhibit pain for pain's sake. This is shame. Like, he shamed them out in front of his of their communities, to where now all the ones who weren't them would be looked at and said, "Hey, yeah, you're the one who Gideon took out back to the lick log," and you know that's the picture there.
Yeah, and that's bad enough. But notice what happens when he gets to the next city. Really, it's not just shame there at Penuel. What does he do to all of the men of the city?
Yeah.
He kills them all, right? He wipes out a city. Well, what's going to happen at the very end of the book of Judges, right? What happens in the epilogue? We're going to have Israel unite to do what? Wipe out a city. And we know from later on, he's going to have a bunch of kids and a bunch of wives. Well, what do you do here? He's acting like the Canaanite. You kill off all the men, and you take all the wives, women as slaves, yeah. Right? as concubines, as slaves in that way. And so here he's acting like a Canaanite. Even the Midianites didn't do this badly to Israel. But here,
yeah, and
he does.
He's basically like, this is straight facts, warlord behavior of every era and generation, which is why we can kind of see that this is the end of spiritual Gideon. You know, the Gideon that could have been is no longer being seen, because he is basically, one way to think about it is he's compensating for the image of his weakness. That he is weak, and so now he's got to do all this stuff to show himself to be strong. When whatever he was doing, what God was needing to be done, 100% success, and people praised God, and Gideon received the blessings that God gave him. Because God was blessing Gideon, like 100% in that process. So what else here is at least important for us before we get to, say, the last two textual box, like verses 22 and following, and then verses 29 and following.
Yeah, I mean, we finally in 18 through 21 finally get back around to the people that Gideon's captured, right? We get back to the captives, and we kind of are missing some of the story, because Gideon's like, hey, where are those guys you killed back home where I lived in Tabor? And they're like, well, they looked like you. They all look like a king. And this is going to be a big deal. A son of a king is going to be really, really important, okay?
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't know what's going on. Have they killed some of Gideon's family? Are they just kind of like buttering him up? We're not sure, but it introduces the concept of kingship for the first time to Israel in the book of Judges. Mm-hmm. And he tries to get his son to kill them in order to kind of further shame them, but his son's too scared, just like his dad's been too scared. And finally he goes and fights them himself, but notice what occurs here. He takes their necklaces and he takes their clothes. In clothing maketh the man.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is that in the ancient world, your clothing is your identity. And there is right here this transformation of Gideon becoming a Midianite king in some ways.
Yeah, I think we kind of coined that Gideon will end up being a dime store pharaoh of a type, where Solomon is the rhinestone pharaoh that we find later. It's like all the jewels, but there's no real substance by the time he's actually in his giant palace. That kind of happens here for Gideon. He is being spiritually made over into a Canaanite now. He's going to dress like a Canaanite. He's going to engage in ways that are Canaanite. And you know, to Edwin's question of what's going on with his level of success and victory, remember that this is not a one day this way, another day another, you know, on and off switch. This is a synopsis of this transformation, and we don't get the rest of the story. We get what's necessary to help us understand the big outcome, but not necessarily all the details that go into the process. There's all kinds of possibilities as to why it takes place. I know Jared gave one in the text chat as well. So moving forward, verse 22, chapter 8. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. Where's God?
Have saved us.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they picked up what Gideon was laying down, right? Gideon, when he said, for the Lord and for Gideon, everybody knew, right? Because this is the context that they're living in, that knew Gideon. And they're like, yeah, you gave us victory. You will be king over us, right? And at first we have, you know, this wonderful statement that seems of faith that Gideon responds, oh, I won't rule over you and my son won't rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. And we're like, look, good, Gideon, faithful, amazing. Look at him saying, let's give the glory to God.
Mm-hmm.
But what's his next request?
Yeah,
what does he ask for?
Yeah.
What does he ask for?
Yeah, give me the earrings that you have so we can build a thing. Like,
and
big giant sign that says, hey, you know, wait a minute. We're going to build a thing out of earrings.
We should be so terrified at this point, because earrings, I mean, this is Our Old Testament ears should be ringing gong bells, alarm bells, like, you know, everything should be going off. Because this word for earrings, this is the same word for earrings that we've seen before in the Exodus, right? Remember when Moses is up on Mount Sinai getting stuff from God, and Aaron, the people said, hey, Aaron, make us gods to bring us back to Egypt. What does Aaron make the golden calf out of?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the same thing. It's a repeat. And one of the things I think is really important, like if we explain it, everyone catches it right away. But to the audience that's listening to this, and they're Israelites and they know their general history, I'm like, hey, wait a minute, that sounds really familiar. This song echoes something for me. I've heard it before. And that's what takes place here, much in the same way that Under Pressure and Ice Ice Baby are echoes of one another. You can kind of catch that musical styling in the opening parts of Elias's work, which is not really his work. That's what's going on here. The same thing. And he goes through the same steps. In verse 27, why don't you read 27 and 28 for us? I think that's probably the capstone text.
And Gideon made an ephod out of the earrings, and he put it in the city, in Ophrah, and all of Israel whored after it there. And it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more. And the land of Israel had 40 years of rest in the days of Gideon.
Yeah. And so,
oh man,
there is a big shift there. It could have been so much, and it was not. Now, did God's purpose of bringing justice and judgment take place? Yes. Did Gideon ride the animal that was God's justice all the way to his destination? No, he got off early and tried to get a piece of success for his own house. I find it interesting, verse 29 and 30, and this is probably a good point to kind of talk about a few things. We've got like 3 more minutes of class time to squeeze all this in, but I think we can do it. Zerubbabel and Gideon are two terms that are used here, but they also typify the change that takes place in these last few verses. Jared, why don't you take the last couple of minutes we've got and just quickly summarize the downfall here. I'm going to throw up, while you're doing that, a couple of funnels and cycles and stuff. We'll start with the cycle.
So we've had him called Gideon for most of the story since the first, right? Since he chopped down the idol. And this Gideon, you know, someone who chops down people, at first he chops down his enemies, and then he chops down Israelites. And here at the end, after he sets up an idol, right? And I know some people want to make the ephod a linen garment or priestly. It's not. You don't make a linen garment out of gold. You make an idol. You make that. That's what you make out of earrings. But now we return, and our inspired narrator says, oh, we're going to call him Jerubbaal. Because remember, that's what he was called when he cut down the altar of Baal. But what does he just put up now? A new idol in his own town. He's become what he destroyed. And this is a little bit of a pun, too, because Jerubbaal can be who let Baal contend against him, but can also be he who contends for Baal. Just like the name Israel, he gets from when he is wrestling with God, but it's also to honor God. And here we have, here he is, and the guy who said, I'm not going to be king. Well, what does he do? He's got 70 sons. He's got many wives. He's got concubines. These are all things the king does. And what does he name his son? Abimelech, which means my daddy is the king.
Yeah. So that kind of shows the end of the full demise of Gideon that you kind of foreshadow with our funnel and with Way's ring structure. In the very end, they take the altar and they go back to pagan living because he has led them to the place where he came from. He's created a whole cycle in his own life. He is the cycle. And the schedule also says we've got to stop right here. So we got to do two things at once. Hey, everybody, thank you for being part of this Bible study. We're really glad that you were here. Jared, thank you for being here for it as well. We want to encourage everyone to keep digging into the text of Judges. Obviously, we get to talk about Abimelech next. And also maybe even a little further. We'll see how we'll plan that out for Wednesday. But everyone take care, be safe, and if you would like to, the Eastside congregation and I'll be part of it. We'll have our encouragement exhortation here in just about 15 minutes at 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Thanks, everybody.